There are three things by way of introduction that I want to say about about the resurrection as it relates to Christianity. The first thing is this, that resurrection is the foundation of Christianity. Now, many people would perhaps be slightly taken aback at that statement and may not necessarily agree with it. Many people would say, if you ask them what is the foundation of Christianity, they would say the crucifixion. They would say if it was not for the crucifixion, there would be no such thing as reconciliation of man to God. There'd be no such thing as justification. There'd be no way in which a man could know his sins forgiven. There'd be no way. And it is because of the death of Jesus Christ on the cross that we can enjoy all these things. This, of course, is perfectly understandable, and to a large extent one would have to agree. But there's one thing we must bear in mind. If Jesus Christ had just died on the cross, and that had been the end of the story, there would never have been any doctrine of reconciliation. There would never have been any doctrine of justification. There could never have ever been any doctrine of forgiveness, because, you see, all that would have happened would have been another man who made extravagant claims would have gone to his death and would have disappeared into oblivion like every other man who died, and therefore, why would anybody ever believe any story like, because he died, man can be reconciled to God? Why would anybody ever believe any story like, because he died, you can have your sins forgiven? Everybody has said he died like everybody else died, because they had to. He died like everybody else does, because they couldn't stave it off any longer. But you see, once we come up with a statement that this one who died, died in a remarkable way, and then rose again from the dead, and thereby defeated death, and thereby demonstrated that he was totally something other, then, of course, we can begin to give credence to these tremendous statements concerning the death of Jesus Christ. If Jesus Christ was not risen from the dead, the cross of Jesus Christ was unmitigated tragedy. If Jesus Christ did not rise again from the dead, the cross of Jesus Christ was simply the end to a very, very interesting, very fascinating life. But it is the resurrection that gives content to the whole of these things. You see, you can have a cross without a resurrection. And all you've got then is tragedy. But you can't have a resurrection without a cross. And therefore, the thing that gives the cross of Jesus Christ its validity is the resurrection of Jesus Christ from among the dead. And therefore, the resurrection is the foundation of Christian experience. If Christ is not risen, our faith is vain. The second thing we need to notice is that the resurrection makes Christianity totally unique. You see, there is no other religion in the world where the founder and general director claimed before he died that he would rise again, and then, according to historical statements, did it. There are many, many, many religions in the world. Some are ancient, some are traditional, some are relatively new. But they all have one thing in common as opposed to Christianity. None of them boast a resurrected leader. I suppose it would be true to say, as far as the major religions of the world are concerned and the modern sects are concerned, that they have one basic thrust. And that is that there is a certain system of living whereby a person can know enrichment here and can know certainty for the future. But it is incumbent upon that person to engage in this certain standard of living that comes from the teachings of its founder. Christianity does not claim to be this at all. Christianity claims very simply that the only thing that gives validity to the teachings of her founder was the resurrection, and the whole content of the teachings of the founder of Christianity is simply this: there is no way that you can fulfill my teachings without my risen power in your life. Therefore, when anybody suggests that Christianity is just like any other religion, when anybody suggests that what we really need is a syncretism of all the religions of the world, they really aren't thinking very carefully. Because there is no way that you can get Christianity to fit into the pattern of all the other major religions. For one very simple reason. The founder and director of Christianity is distinctively unique in that he claimed to rise again from the dead, and the whole content of the Christian message is it is not a religion based on the teachings of the founder. But the whole content of Christianity is it is a relationship whereby you enjoy the power of the risen Lord to enable you to fulfill the teachings that he gave. So this is the second thing that we need to notice concerning the resurrection. Number one, the resurrection is the foundation of Christianity. Number two, it is the resurrection that makes Christianity unique. And thirdly, the resurrection is therefore the point of controversy. Now, the religions, of course, know perfectly well that the unique, distinctive concerning Christianity is the resurrection. Therefore, they are violent opponents of the concept of resurrection. Now, the people who want nothing to do with any kind of religion and nothing to do with Christianity, of course, will direct their attacks primarily at the resurrection of Jesus Christ from among the dead. And so, on the subject of the resurrection, the battle is joined. Those who want to have an intelligent Christianity have to have it intelligently rooted in the resurrection of Jesus Christ from among the dead. Those who want to downgrade Christianity know that they have got to hit it at the point of the resurrection. And this is where the battle is to be found. If ever you're witnessing and you find somebody wants to argue or debate or discuss on the whole subject of Christianity, let me give you a very, very simple rule. Get them onto the resurrection as quickly as you possibly can, and don't waste time fooling around with most of the other things that people want to argue about. Because most of the things that people argue about, their argument's as good as anybody else's. But when you get down to the resurrection, this is where it's at. And so this Christian statement, as contained in the Apostles' Creed, states categorically, on the third day, he having been crucified, dead, buried, descended into Hades, categorically rose again from the dead. Now then, let's look at three basic things here concerning this concept of the resurrection, this teaching of the resurrection. First of all, we'll talk about what I would call the historical ingredients of the resurrection, how the whole story comes about. And then, secondly, we'll deal with some traditional ideas of the resurrection that the various theories that are abroad in the world today. And then we'll finish up with some spiritual implications of the resurrection. First of all, then, the historical ingredients of the resurrection. It's very important for us to notice that the Bible claims to be a historically accurate and a historically viable document. Now, you should have this firmly in your thinking. Because, you see, there are many people today who believe many, many things concerning history, and the reason they believe them is quite simply that there have been certain documents handed down to us in which these facts of history have been contained. But these same people then get cold feet over anything to do with Christianity. And they will even tell you this, well, of course, I believe Napoleon lived and I believe Napoleon died because history teaches so, but I don't believe in Jesus Christ. And you ask them why, and they say, I just don't. But you see, their big problem is this. If they believe in the existence and the death and the life of Napoleon because, quote, history tells them so, end quote, they have absolutely no alternative but to believe in Jesus Christ for the identical reason, quote, because history tells them so. You see, many people seem to think that you must believe all historical documents unless they are biblical historical documents. They seem to think that if a document is biblical, it cannot be historical, and if it is historical, it will not be biblical. This is a totally erroneous concept. It is absolutely incorrect because the biblical documents are historically authenticated. And we see in these things not just vague spiritual concepts that are unrelated to reality down here on earth. We see in these scriptures historical statements that have been accurately and carefully authenticated. And therefore, we have certain statements that we must be confronted with. Statement number one from the historical record of this Christian doctrine in the Bible is this: Jesus Christ lived. Now, that's a perfectly obvious statement. We need to read the historical data that we have available to us on this subject. Statement number two in the historically authenticated documents is this: Jesus Christ was crucified. This, of course, is something that we need to be confronted with. We need to be fully conversant with what the historical documents say about it. Statement number three: Jesus Christ was buried and his tomb was carefully marked by people who were in the position to do so at the time. Statement number four in the historically authenticated documents is this: 3 days later, this tomb was found to be empty. Now, these are the basic ingredients of the beginning of the whole teaching of the doctrine. Now, let's check on it very carefully. Historically authenticated documents say Christ lived, Christ was crucified, Christ was buried, his tomb was marked, and 3 days later, the tomb was empty. Now, if you want a Conan Doyle sort of approach to this, I would suggest to you that Christianity hinges on what we could call the case of the missing corpse. Because that's where the whole thing comes alive. And the big question that everybody who is intelligently concerned of Christianity must always ask himself is this: what on earth happened to Jesus Christ? I may add here, for what it's worth, it isn't worth very much, but in addition to the biblical historical documents, we do have secular historians who give us these basic facts concerning Jesus Christ. Men like Josephus and Tacitus and others. They will tell you in their historical documents, Christ lived, Christ was crucified, Christ was buried, the tomb was empty. Now then, the question is this. What happened to the body? What on earth happened to Jesus Christ? Well, there are various theories, and I want to suggest to you four basic ones. The first theory that is quite common is what we will call the delusion theory. The second theory is what is commonly known as the swoon theory. The third one is the fraud theory. And the fourth one is the miracle theory. Now, we're going to look in each of these, into each of these theories. It isn't going to be a biblical exposition this morning because we've had quite a lot of those recently on the resurrection. We're going to hit it from a different angle. Let's try and evaluate what people say concerning the missing body of Jesus Christ, the empty tomb, when they project to us what is called the delusion theory. The delusion theory simply states this. We got the whole idea of the resurrection, say these people, from his disciples. And of course, the perfectly obvious answer to the whole problem is this, that these disciples were deluded. They all had hallucinations. And therefore, they scoff at Christianity and say, it is absolutely unbelievable that you can get something that has been perpetuated for 1900 years, and the whole thing has been perpetuated because a little handful of stupid fishermen have delusions. They suffered from hallucinations, and these unbelievable people thought that they saw an empty tomb and thought that the person that they knew perfectly well had died appeared to them later on. And they say the whole thing is rank hallucination. There is absolutely no validity in the thing at all. It is a total delusion. Now, what do you say to a person who tells you that? Well, I think there are one or two things that we need to be aware of here. The first thing is this. I think I'm right in saying these things. You can check them if you wish with experts in these areas. But the first thing that we need to notice is that hallucinations usually concern an expected event. In other words, if people are really looking for something and really want it to happen, they can produce hallucinations in their own experience which are nothing more than wish fulfillment. Oh, I wish such and such a thing would happen. I wish it, I wish it, I wish it, I wish it. They get themselves into such a psychological and emotional state that in the end they can produce in their mind's eye a picture of that which they wished would happen to actually have happened. This is nothing more than wish fulfillment. It is a rank hallucination. You will, of course, have met people who suffer from wish fulfillment. You will have met people who suffer from downright hallucinations. But the important thing to remember about these hallucinations is this. They always concern something that is half expected by those people. Now, of course, many people make a very fundamental error here. They think that the disciples expected Jesus Christ to rise again from the dead. They didn't. In fact, if you read the records concerning the disciples when Jesus Christ was crucified, there's one thing that you can write right across their experience in great big capital letters, despair. They were absolutely broken men. The bottom had dropped out of their world. They were absolutely finished. In fact, two of them walking along the road to Emmaus gave their testimony. And they were so sad as they walked along. And when a stranger joined them, they said, he said, what's wrong with you? And they said, haven't you heard what's happened in Jerusalem? He said, what things? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth, he was being killed, he's being crucified, he's been murdered. Haven't you heard about it? And he said, go on. And they said, well, we thought that he was the one who would deliver Israel. We thought this. Where was Peter? Where was John? Where were these people on the road to Emmaus? Every single one of them forsook him and fled because suddenly the whole bottom had dropped out of their life. And there was one thing they did not expect to happen. That was the resurrection from among the dead. Now, of course, he had predicted it, but they didn't get the message. In fact, if they really honestly believed that the resurrection was going to happen, guess where they would have spent that weekend? They'd have spent that weekend hiding behind trees and rocks and blades of grass in the garden to make absolutely certain that they were there. Never seen a resurrection. Come and see the resurrection. 3 days from now, there's going to be the biggest spectacular ever seen. Come on, fellas. They'd have been there. Not one of them was. And the last thing they expected was the resurrection from among the dead. Therefore, the theory of hallucinations falls on hard times Because hallucinations are the wish fulfillment of expected events. These fellows didn't expect it. The second thing to remember about a hallucination is this, that hallucinations are individualistic. In other words, when one person has a hallucination, they have their own special hallucination, and when the person next to them has one, they have a different one. And when somebody else has one, they have a different one. They're all individualistic. They're all closely related to the personality concerned. They're all closely related to the desires and aspirations and longings of that person concerned. But here, we don't have individualistic hallucinations suggested at all. We have one. And the remarkable thing about it is this, they all claim to have seen the same thing. You say it was only a handful. No, if you check carefully, there were over 550 witnesses to a resurrection appearance of Jesus Christ. Always remember this, over 550. And to suggest that 550 people are going to have a wish fulfillment fulfilled, and they all wish for the same thing, and it was all identical, and they all saw the same thing, is just against the rules of hallucination. It doesn't wash. That's the second thing to bear in mind. The third thing to bear in mind is this, that hallucinations only occur in certain types of people. There are some people who are prone to this sort of thing. There's some people who are this way inclined. There are other hard-headed people, hard-nosed people, that never have a hallucination if they live to be 950. No way. They just are down-to-earth, nitty-gritty sort of people and say, all this bit about hallucination, I forget the whole thing. And there are other mystical people, and they can go around, they can pull them out of a hat as easy as winking. You see, you just don't have everybody having hallucinations. There are certain groups of people who have them and certain types who don't. It's a remarkable thing, therefore, that every one of the disciples had one when we know perfectly well that they were all completely different. You see, the whole theory of hallucination falls on hard times when you really look into what is involved. And the fourth thing that we need to notice is this, that hallucinations usually go on recurring over a period of up to 2 years. And yet, as far as this is concerned, they're simply talking about an immediate event that was repeated over a very brief period of time. In fact, we know that just a few days later, he ascended into heaven. And this was not a recurring thing over a considerable amount of time. Therefore, the whole teaching, the whole understanding that we have of hallucinations and delusions would suggest that it would be extremely difficult for anybody seriously to take the theory of some people concerning the empty tomb, that it was simply delusion and these people were simply having hallucinations. The second theory is an interesting one. It's what we call the swoon theory. This theory is quite simple. He says, well, of course, these early disciples, these biblical historians, were mistaken. They thought that Jesus Christ had risen again from the dead. But in actual fact, what really happened was that he didn't really die. He just went into a deep swoon. But we need to look very carefully into the circumstances here. We know, according to the historical record, that Jesus Christ was scourged. We know that many men died under scourging. We know that he was buffeted, maltreated. We know that he was taken up the road to Calvary. We know that he was given his cross to carry and collapsed under the weight. We know that he was crucified. We know it was an agonizing, lingering death. We know that there were certain people, experts in crucifixion there at the time, the Roman centurion and his soldiers. We know that they carefully inspected the bodies, and we know that these people who are experts in crucifixion were amazed when they came to him to discover him already dead. Remember that the idea was that they should break his legs in order to expedite his decease, but when they came to him, it was not necessary. Therefore, they did not break them, fulfilling the Old Testament prophecy. But one of them, for some reason known only to himself, took a spear and from his lower position thrust it up through the intestines, through the bowels, upwards into the body that was impaled on the cross, and according to the records, out of it flowed blood and water. We then know that the body was taken down, was wrapped like an Egyptian mummy in grave clothes, that it was placed in a tomb, that a stone that took many men to move was placed against the tomb, and that 3 days later, the stone was found to be rolled away. The grave clothes, strangely enough, were found to be in position, but the body had gone. Now, those are the facts that we have outlined for us in the historical record. Now then, as soon as you look into all these details, you'll find that whatever else happened, it certainly wasn't a swoon situation. The first thing to bear in mind is this, that in addition to all the suffering and the weakness that he had has resulted from all his suffering through the trial and through the scourging and this sort of thing, and the time that he had spent on the cross, we must remember this, that the wound from the spear that brought forth blood and water would have been a fatal wound. In all probability, it meant the puncturing of the heart. And so this would have been a fatal wound. And so this militates against any theory of him just purely swooning. The second thing, that's a basically medical factor. The second thing, of course, is the basically physical factor, and that is this, that here is somebody who's gone through all this with a fatal wound, being shut up without food or water, wrapped up in stifling, suffocating grave clothes for 3 days and three nights in a tomb, and suddenly, for some inexplicable reason, waking up, getting out of his grave clothes, and being able to move a stone that it had taken many men to put in place. This just plainly is against common sense. It just doesn't fit. In addition to this, there's the psychological factors. If Jesus Christ did swoon, there's no question about it that 3 days after all that he had gone through, he was more dead than alive. He was just a physical wreck. He was absolutely shattered, and yet the interesting thing about it is this. Christianity basically is born when this person who purportedly swoons suddenly stands in the middle of his defeated supporters and says, "Hail!" and turns them on. Now, why would a group of dispirited, disillusioned, defeated men who are in fear of their lives suddenly be turned on by a wreck who comes in having swooned and just suddenly got himself out of the mess he was in? All that would have happened would have been that he'd have joined their ranks and they'd all got out of Jerusalem as quick as they could and they'd have been carrying him. Exactly the reverse happened. And the psychological factors that are against the swoon theory are simply this, that this man, if he swooned, who was obviously more dead than alive, had the remarkable ability to infuse life into dead people and had the remarkable ability to turn dispirited people into the most formidable group of men that this world has ever known. The swoon theory falls on hard times. But perhaps the biggest argument against the swoon theory is what we would call the moral factor. The moral factor is simply this, that Jesus Christ only swooned, didn't really die, and I say this very carefully, but I want you to hear it. If Jesus Christ swooned and did not really die, Jesus Christ is the biggest fake and the biggest con man that this world has ever known. Because, you see, the historical record is this. After he recovered from his swoon, he went around and told rank lies, totally misleading people, and said that he was risen from the dead as he would promise. And if he'd swooned, he was wrong. He was a trickster, a folk, a fake, a charlatan, a rogue, and a con man. And it's interesting that Christianity has developed the way it had from such a shady beginning. The swoon theory doesn't hold water. For those reasons, the medical factors, the physical factors, the psychological factors, and the moral factors. The third theory then, the fraud theory. Remember the statements that we have, Christ lived, Christ was crucified, Christ was buried, placed in the tomb, and the tomb was subsequently found to be empty. The third theory that comes now is simply this, the reason the tomb was empty was that the body was stolen, it's obvious. And after the body had been stolen, then of course all that was necessary was for these people, having stolen the body, to go around and tell this ridiculous story, our Jesus Christ being risen from the dead. This is a theory that you need to look into, but there are one or two factors of which you need to be very carefully aware. The first thing is this. If it is true, if it is really true, and you must consider it, that the reason that the body was missing and the reason the tomb was empty was simply that somewhere along the line the disciples stole the body, there are a number of things that we've got to look into here. One thing is this. How was it that totally demoralized men should suddenly discover the courage and the know-how and the readiness and the willingness to steal the body? How did they cope with the guard? How did they dare break the seal of authority on the tomb? How did these demoralized, defeated men who had dispersed all over the whole area suddenly get together, work out a plan, and get away with it so effectively? You're hard put to give an answer for that. But there's an even harder question that you have to ask is this. Why then did these stupid men go around and preach a gospel that was based on the resurrection when they knew perfectly well it wasn't true if they had stolen the body? And there's an even bigger question you've got to ask. And why on earth did these stupid men, without exception, lay down their lives for this gospel when they knew that the whole thing was based on a fraud? And the answer is this. There is no way that you can really honestly believe that the disciples stole the body for those reasons. The second thing, of course, that you need to notice is this. There's a remarkable contradiction in the story upon which this whole theory of the stealing of the body hinges. This was the first argument against the resurrection that was going around Jerusalem within a matter of days. And the theory came from the story of the guards. And the guards went before their commanding officers and did something that guards never do before their commanding officers. "Sir," they said, "we want to report that we were asleep on duty." You never do that. If you go to sleep on duty and nobody found out, you just say, "Thank the Lord for that. I got away with it. Let's make sure it doesn't happen again." These men, for some strange reason, volunteered. "We went to sleep on duty." But then they said a remarkable thing. "While we were asleep, the disciples came and stole the body." Now, if you're thinking with half a thought, and I know it's early on the Sunday morning, and it's not a very nice morning either, so it's kind of dull. But one thing you need to realize is this. If you're thinking with half a thought, you would immediately say to yourself, "Excuse me, but if you were asleep when the event took place, how do you know who stole the body?" Because, you see, what these silly people are saying is this. While we were asleep, we saw. And you just don't see while you're asleep. And therefore, this whole theory of the fraud, that these disciples stole the body, falls right down because the evidence upon which it is based is totally unacceptable. It is pure hearsay. It has absolutely nothing to do with what these purported witnesses saw or heard or felt. Nothing to do with it. They said they were asleep, and whilst they were asleep, this happened. So their evidence is unacceptable. It is unlikely that demoralized disciples would gather themselves together and steal the body. It is absolutely unlikely that these demoralized men would steal the body and then preach the gospel that was a fraud and die for it. It is highly unlikely that we can accept the testimony of what some people saw while they were asleep. This is what we must do if we accept the fraud theory. The third thing to remember, of course, is this, the grave clothes. Just come into the tomb with me for a moment. We've got past the guard. We slugged them. We've managed to break the seal, and we've managed to roll away the stone, which takes many men to roll away. It's in the dead of night. We're in a hurry. What do we do? There's the body. What do we want? We want the body. What do? We grab the body. Then what do? We get out quick. Very interesting thing, therefore, happens according to the historical data, which is this, that for some unknown reason, these grave robbers were remarkably leisurely grave robbers. Do you know what they did if they actually stole the body? These dispirited, defeated, frightened, demoralized men, they actually went in, slugged the guards, broke the seal, rolled away the stone, got the body. Instead of grabbing the body and getting out of there quick, they carefully and meticulously unrolled yards and yards and yards and yards of bandages in which the body was bound. It was had pounds of spices mixed up with it. It was probably set hard like a plaster cast. And then, after they got the body out, somebody said, "Hold this a minute. I'm going to roll it back up again." You see? This is what you must believe if you believe the theory of the fraud. Because, you see, the Bible, the historical documents are very, very careful to point out that the grave clothes were laying in the place. And the whole idea here is this, that they were laying there, not just, you know, collapsed, but they were laying there as if the body was still in it. You're hard put with this fraud theory. Because of the condition of the disciples, because of the contradictions of the guards, because of the grave clothes. And then, of course, the motivation. What would have been the motivation for stealing the body? Well, the motivation for stealing the body, if, of course, the disciples did it, was to prove the resurrection. But the accounts that we have, of course, militate absolutely against this for the very simple reason they were not trying to prove a resurrection because resurrection had never entered their heads. There is absolutely no motivation for these men to do this thing. Some people, of course, have suggested that what happened was that not that the disciples stole the body, but in actual fact, some of the religious leaders stole the body. The reason they stole the body was simply this. They knew that there were going to be many problems with these Christians, or they weren't called Christians yet, and therefore, if they could just get rid of this body, this tomb would never become a shrine. And therefore, if they could get rid of the body and get rid of the shrine, then that was great. And they would knock the thing in their head. But there's a big problem with this. Even if that was their motivation, and even if that was what they did, why then did they allow Christianity to take root? You see, in Jerusalem, within a matter of days, Peter stands up, preaches a message, 3,000 people are converted, and then 2,000, then up to 5,000, and thousands of people, and then eventually, even some of the priests get converted, and then somebody says, you fill Jerusalem with your doctrine, and there's a riot all over the place, and the whole thing hinges on what? The resurrection. And those people who are against Christianity, this budding thing, they want to knock it in the head, and the whole message is based on the resurrection. If you want to knock a message in the head that's based on the resurrection, and you've got the body, what do? You bring the body out. And you say, resurrection? Baloney! Here's the body. That's the end of Christianity. They didn't bring it out for one very simple reason. They didn't have it. We're still left with the case of the missing corpse. What happened to it? Did he swoon? Were the witnesses deluded? Was it a big fraud? Or a big trick? And the very interesting thing is this. If you go around the Holy Land, you'll find that every street corner there's a shrine to somebody or other. You'll find all kinds of people having all kinds of pilgrimages, but the remarkable thing about it is this. Have you ever thought about this? Nobody has ever come up with the burying place of Jesus Christ. Isn't that interesting? You know, the obvious thing is this. Christians, where do they go? They go to Jerusalem. Why? Jesus was buried there. What do? They go immediately to visit the shrine of their leader. You see, every other religion has its shrine where its leader was buried, and what do? The big thing you do in your religious life is make a pilgrimage and go there. You never heard of a Christian making a pilgrimage to the tomb of Jesus Christ because there's never been one. There isn't a shrine in Christianity, there isn't one. Isn't that interesting? You thought someone would have dreamt up one. I mean, there's a lot of money in that. But nobody did. And that's all you've got to do if the body was stolen. If it was a fraud. All right, what's the fourth alternative? The fourth alternative is what we call the miracle theory. The miracle theory is simply this. That a miracle took place. You know, that's quite simple, isn't it? Jesus Christ lived, Jesus Christ was crucified, Jesus Christ died, Jesus Christ was buried. He was put in a tomb, the tomb was marked, and subsequently the tomb was found to be empty. The fourth theory is this. A miracle took place. Now, can any intelligent person honestly, genuinely believe in this? Well, the answer is, oh yes. Now, of course, the big argument against the miracle theory is simply this. Miracles don't happen. That's no argument to say that miracles don't happen. To say that a miracle does not happen, you've got to define exactly what a miracle is. And to say that a miracle does not happen, you have got to know all the eventualities that could take place in this universe. And the biggest thing you can say, honestly and genuinely, concerning phenomena that are abroad in our universe today, is that this would probably not be the case. To say dogmatically this cannot be the case is a rather dangerous stance to take. A lot of people, particularly scientists today, don't talk as dogmatically as they used to be about impossibility. They now talk more carefully about improbability. Always remember the difference between an impossibility and an improbability. Now, the embarrassing thing about an improbability is this. Whilst it is improbable, it is not impossible. Therefore, you do not say it could not happen. All you would say is it is highly unlikely that it would happen. But as soon as you say it is highly unlikely that something would happen, you've always got to admit that there's one chance in a million it might. And this is the problem of the person who rejects any miracle theory. Now, then, militating against that is considerable evidence. The first part of the evidence I would suggest to you is what we call the direct evidence, which I've already quoted to you. According to the records, there were, in addition of 11 appearances subsequent to the resurrection, subsequent to the missing body, and this direct evidence concerns not only 11 specific appearances, but these appearances were projected to over 550 people. Now, on one occasion, there were more than 500 at one time. This is the biggest argument against the delusion theory, because it just doesn't happen that all these people get deluded.
So the direct evidence upon which we base it is this. After the tomb was found to be empty, somebody passing himself off as Jesus Christ appears on over 11 occasions to in excess of 550 people. This is evidence submitted. The second thing, the circumstantial evidence that we look into is this. On top of the whole idea of the appearances, the direct evidence, we have this. That from a circumstantial point of view, would it be unreasonable to believe that Jesus Christ would do something highly improbable? The answer is unquestionably yes, because he'd spent his life doing in unlikely things. If the records are correct, he'd raise the dead. If the records are correct, he'd walked on the water. If the records are correct, he turned water into wine. If the records are correct, he was a miracle worker. In actual fact, if the records are correct, it's almost the sort of thing you'd expect him to do. Because, you see, for some strange reason, he was able to project to his contemporaries, and always remember this, the contemporaries of Jesus Christ had a much higher opinion than most of the people who have the advantage of being 1,900 years away from the event. And the contemporaries of Jesus Christ were absolutely enthralled with the miracles and signs and wonders that he did. You remember in that early apostolic sermon? The great statement that was given was this, that Jesus Christ, a man of God, a man of Nazareth, was approved of God by miracles and signs and wonders that God did by him. In other words, the attestation of the validity of the claims of Jesus Christ according to the apostolic message to his contemporaries was this, miracles, signs, and wonders. Nobody argued, they all knew. They all knew this character, whoever he was, had gone around, quit his carpentry, and took up the miracle business. They all knew that whatever he was and whatever he claimed to be, there was no question about it, he did unbelievably remarkable things. Therefore, the circumstantial evidence goes right behind. This is exactly the sort of thing you'd expect him to do. He was unique. This is a unique thing. It is not out of character. The second part of circumstantial evidence is this, the revolution in the disciples. What happened to Peter? After running away from a little girl in Jerusalem, a few weeks later, 7 weeks later, he stands up in the same city, preaches his heart out, and 3,000 people are so convinced of what he is saying that their lives are totally changed. Through a man who 7 weeks earlier was denying everything that now he preaches with conviction. What happened? What happened to James, the Lord's brother, who had no time for his brother, who thought he was some kind of a kook, but in a very, very short time became the head of the Christian church in Jerusalem? Answer, his brother appeared to him having risen from the dead. And right the way down the line, you have some interesting circumstantial evidence here, which is simply this. There was a remarkable revolutionary change in the lives of those disciples. So add the circumstantial evidence of the uniqueness of Christ to the revolution in the disciples, and then a third thing, the miracle of the church. Now I know that the church has her critics and she's earned most of them. But I'm also firmly convinced of this, that one of the most remarkable miracles that there has ever been on the face of God's earth is the institution and the ongoing of the Church of Jesus Christ that at this moment numbers literally millions from every tongue, from every class, from the background of every creed, of every color, every tribe and kindred and tongue and nation. They're there and they're one in Christ. And the remarkable thing about it is this. It all started from a handful of men who at the moment of crisis in their leader's life forsook him and fled. It's an utter miracle. Is it based on a delusion? Is it based on a fraud? Is it based on a phony? Or could this miracle be the product of a miracle? What is most likely, that the miracle of the Church of Jesus Christ was built on a swoon theory, was built on a delusion theory, was built on a perpetrated confidence trick, or was built on a miracle? The answer is it was built on a miracle. The circumstantial evidence is pretty formidable. And fourthly, the real evidence, which is simply this, the subjective experience of millions. Can millions of people be absolutely wrong when they testify to the fact that when they invited Jesus Christ to do what he promised to do, he did it? Can millions of people be wrong when from their subjective experience they say, I read in the Word of God that Jesus Christ would do this, 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 and this, and I want you to come and meet my family and see the evidence, and I want you to come to my workplace and see the evidence, and I want you to look at my own life and see the evidence? Can they all be wrong? The answer is it is highly unlikely that they can. add the direct evidence to the circumstantial evidence to the real evidence, and you come up with some pretty interesting conclusions. There is absolutely no reason to disbelieve the miracle theory of the resurrection. In fact, you would be harder put to accept the delusion theory, the fraud theory, or the swoon theory than you would be to accept the miracle theory. Where does this leave us? What are the spiritual implications? Very simply, the resurrection of Jesus Christ thought through gives you great solid intellectual basis for your faith. And I want to underline this. I am appalled at the general lack of intellectual conviction concerning the Christian faith that there is abroad in literally thousands of Christians today. If you ask them to give a reason for the hope that is in them, the only reason they can give is, I've always believed it. And what they need to do is to get into the resurrection, because it gives you a solid intellectual basis for your faith. The second thing, of course, is this. It gives tangible evidence of afterlife. Many theories are abroad concerning what happens when you die. Everybody's interested in that because they know it's coming. And some people say, when you're dead, you're done with. This is a very euphemistic theory that is totally unrelated to facts. It is, in many instances, wishful thinking. Other people say, you're reincarnated. This is totally wishful thinking. And the interesting thing about it is this, that some people say one thing and some people say the other, and they're all theories that do not pretend to be based on fact. But if Jesus Christ rose again from the dead, we've got our one piece of really hard-nosed, tangible evidence concerning the afterlife. And you forget about theories, and you forget about arguments, and you say, look, folks, there's some hard-nosed, tangible evidence here. Jesus Christ rose again from the dead, living tangible evidence of the validity of the afterlife. And if he did it, blazed the trail down there and back again, let's listen to what he says about the afterlife. This is the second spiritual implication. The third one, of course, is this. It is a practical illustration of divine power. And the scriptures teach us quite categorically that the resurrection was an illustration of the sort of thing that God can do for people down here while they live and down here when they die. For if the spirit of him that raised up Christ from the dead dwells in you, he also that raised up Christ from the dead shall make your mortal body come alive by his spirit that dwelleth in you. That's what the resurrection's for. It gives you a practical illustration of divine power. If the church of Jesus Christ should be demonstrating one thing more than another, it is the divine power of the resurrection Christ through the Holy Spirit, who is a motivating dynamic. The fourth thing is this. It brings an unavoidable challenge to response. If Jesus Christ is risen, he has given you enough grounds for intellectual conversion. Some of the most striking Christians that we have seen in modern days have been men who had an initially intellectual conversion. They found that they could not refuse Jesus Christ and be intellectually honest. I'm firmly convinced of this, that when people honestly and openly look into the facts presented to them concerning the whole bit of the resurrection, they're going to be hard put to being intellectually honest and saying no to Jesus Christ. The Lord Chief Justice of England said this: if the evidence that we have available to us concerning the purported resurrection of Jesus Christ were presented in a court of law, no intelligent jury could ever bring in any other verdict than that it is utterly and totally true. Therefore, you will not be surprised when I look you straight in the face and say, I believe in God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and in Jesus Christ, his only Son, our Lord, who was born, conceived of the Holy Ghost, born of the Virgin Mary, suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, dead, and buried. He descended into hell, and on the third day he rose again from the dead. And he hasn't died since. He's in great shape. Christ the Lord is risen today. Hallelujah.